Her lips were black scabs, burned and cracked down into the living meat. Her eyelids were swollen, as though stung by bees, and she peered up at him like a blind old crone through slits that were caked with dried yellow mucus. The flesh had fallen off her body and her face. Her arms were skeletal, and her cheekbones seemed to push through the skin. Her hands were blackened claws, the nails torn down into the quick. She crouched like an animal over the flat leaves of the vine, and she had broken open one of the wild green melons with her fingers and stuffed pulp into her ruined mouth. The juice ran down her chin, cutting a runnel through the dirt that plastered her skin. "Louise!" He went down on one knee, facing her. "Louise!" His voice choked. She made a little mewling sound in her throat and then touched her hair in a heartbreakingly feminine gesture, trying to smooth the stiff, dust-caked tresses. "Is it?" she croaked, peering at him with bloodshot eyes from slits of sun-swollen red lids. It isn't." Fumbling, she tried to cover one soft white breast with the rags of her blouse. She started to shake wildly and uncontrollably, and then she closed her eyes tightly. He reached out gently, and at his touch she collapsed against his chest, still shaking, and he held her. She felt light and frail as a child. "I knew," she mumbled. "It didn't make sense, but I knew somehow that you would come." "Will you douse the lantern, Ralph?" Kathy whispered, and her eyes were huge and dark and piteous as she crept in under the canvas of his wagon. "Why?" he asked, smiling, propping himself on one elbow on the wagon cot.
"Somebody may come."
"Your father and mother are still at Lobengula's kraal. There's nobody."
"My sister, Selina."
"Selina is long ago asleep, dreaming of Brother Jordan, no doubt. We're alone, Kathy, all alone. So why should we put out the lantern?"
"Because I'm shy, then," she said, and blushed a new shade of scarlet. "All you ever do is tease me. I wish I'd never come."
"Oh, Kathy." His chuckle was fond and indulgent, and he sat up on his cot, and the blanket slid to his waist. Quickly she averted her eyes from his naked chest and muscled upper arms. The skin was so white and marble-smooth in comparison to his brown forearms and face. It set strange, unfamiliar emotions loose within her.
"Come!"
He caught her wrist and drew her towards the cot, but she hung back until he jerked her forward, and taken off balance, she fell across his legs. Before she could break free, he had taken a handful of the thick, dark hair at the back of her head and turned her pale face up to his mouth. For a while she continued to struggle unconvincingly, and then her whole body softened, like wax in the candle flame, and seemed to melt over him. "Do you still wish you hadn't come, Kathy?" he asked, but she could not reply. Instead, she tightened her arms around his neck convulsively. Once more she searched for his mouth with hers, and made a little moaning sound. He goaded her with his mouth and tongue, the way Lil had first taught him so long ago, and she was defenceless as a beautiful, soft-bodied insect in the spider's gossamer toils. It excited him, as none of the practiced and calculating women on whom he had spent his gold sovereigns ever had. His own breathing started to hunt roughly, and his fingers shook at the lacings of her bodice. The skin of her shoulder was without blemish, silky and warm. He touched it with the tip of his tongue, and she shuddered and gasped. But when he pulled down the light cotton, she shrugged her shoulders to let the cloth come free. It caught for a moment and then slid to the level of her lowest rib. He was unprepared for those tender and terribly vulnerable young breasts, so pale and rosy-tipped, and yet at the same time hard and jubilant in their marvellous symmetry. He stared at her body, and she watched him through half-closed lids, but made no effort to cover herself, though her cheeks were wildly flushed and her lips trembled as she whispered, "No, Ralph, I don't want to go. Not now or ever." The lantern, he reached for it, but now she caught his hand. "No, Ralph, I'm not ashamed of you and me. I don't want darkness. I want to see your dear face." She jerked the ribbon loose from her waist and then lifted her dress over her head and let it flutter to the wagon floor. Her limbs were long and coltish, her hips still bony as a boy's, and her belly concave as a greyhound's above the dark triangular bush of her womanhood. Her skin shone in the lantern light with that peculiar lustre of healthy, vibrant youth. He stared at it for only an instant, and then she had lifted the corner of the rough woolen blanket and slid in under it, the long, slim arms and legs wrapped around him.
"There's nothing I would not do for you. I would steal and lie and cheat, and even kill for you, my wonderful, beautiful Ralph," she whispered. "I'm not sure what a man and woman do, but if you show me, I'll be the happiest girl on this earth to do it with you."
"Kathy, I didn't mean this to happen," he tried with the last sudden lash of his conscience to push her away.
"I did," she said, clinging stubbornly to him. "Why else do you think I came here?"
"Kathy,
I love you, Ralph. I've loved you from the very first moment I ever saw you."
"I love you, Kathy." And he was amazed to find that what he said was the truth. "I really and truly love you," he said again. And then later, much later, "I didn't realize how much until now."
"I didn't know that it would be like this," she whispered. "I've thought about it often, every day since you first came to Carmi. I even read about it in the Bible. It says that David knew her. Do we know each other now, Ralph?"
"I want to know you much better, and more often," he grinned at her, his tousled hair still damp with sweat.
"I felt as though I had fallen through a dark hole in my soul into another beautiful world, and I didn't want to come back again."
Kathy's voice was awed and marvelling, as though she were the first in all the infinite lists of creation to experience it.
"Didn't you feel that, Ralph?"
They held each other close under the blanket, and they talked softly, examining each other's faces in the yellow lantern light, breaking off every few minutes to kiss the other's throat and eyelids and lips. It was Kathy who pulled away at last.
"I don't want to know the time, but listen to the birds. It'll be light too soon."
Then with a rush of words,
"Oh, Ralph, I don't want you to go."
"It will not be for long, I promise you. Then I will be back."
"Take me with you."
"You know I can't."
"Why not?"
"Because it's dangerous, isn't it?" But he avoided the question by trying to kiss her again. She put her hand over his mouth.
"I'll die a little every moment of the time you are gone, but I'll pray for you. I'll pray that Lobengulia's warriors do not find you."
"Don't worry about me," he chuckled fondly. "We'll fall through that dark hole in your soul again soon."
"Promise," she whispered, and brushed the damp curls off his forehead with her lips. "Promise me you'll come back, my beautiful, beautiful darling Ralph."
Ralph started his wagon train south again on the road to the Shashi River, and for the first morning he rode at the head of the unusually lightly loaded vehicles. At noon he gave the order to outspan. He and Itsasi slept away the hot afternoon while the bullocks and horses grazed and rested. Then at dusk they cut the 5 chosen bullocks out of the herd and tied them to the wagon wheels by leather reins around the boss of their horns while they fitted the backpacks. Ralph and Itsasi had selected these beasts for their strength and willingness, and during the long trek up from Kimberley he had trained them to accept these unusual burdens with resigned docility. Jordan had provided Ralph with the precise measurements and weight of the bird statue that now graced the entrance to Mr. Rhodes's new mansion, Grote Skue. And Ralph had used these figures to design the backpacks and constructed them with his own hands, not trusting anyone else with his secret intentions. Each pack could carry 2 statues like the one at Grote Skue. They would be slung in woven nets of good manila rope on each side of the bullock, and Ralph had worked meticulously to ensure a perfect fit of the saddle to protect the beast's back from galling and prevent the load from shifting even over the roughest ground or on the steepest inclines. Now, when Itsasi, the little Zulu driver, led the file of 3 bullocks quietly out of the camp and disappeared into the darkening forest, they followed meekly. Ralph stayed behind just long enough to repeat his orders to the other drivers.
You'll double march to the Shashi River. If the border impis question where I am, you will tell them I am hunting to the east with the king's permission, and that you expect me to rejoin the wagons at any time. Do you understand?
I understand, Nkosi,
said Amfan, who, although now promoted from forelooper to driver, still answered to the name of boy. Once across the Shashi, you will trek as far as the Bushman Wells, 5 days' march beyond the frontier. Lobengula's impis will not follow you that far. Wait there until I come. Do you understand, Amfan?
I understand, Nkosi.
Then repeat it to me. Satisfied at last, Ralph stepped up into Tom's stirrup and looked down at them from his back. Go swiftly, he said.
Go in peace, Nkosi.
He trotted out of camp, following Isasi's bullock train and dragging behind him a bulky branch of thorn mimosa to sweep their spoor clean. By mid-morning the following day, they were well clear of the wagon road and had entered the mystical Matopus Hills. While the oxen grazed and rested, Ralph rode ahead to mark a trail between the soaring granite kopjes and through the deep and sullen gorges. At dark, they resaddled the bullocks with their packs and went on. The next day, Ralph made a noon observation of the sun with the old brass sextant. From experience, he made allowance for the cumulative error in his boxed chronometer, and worked out a position which he knew was accurate to within 10 miles. Also from experience, he knew that his father's observations, made before he was born, were usually as accurate. Without them, he would never have found the caches of ivory which had been the start of his growing fortune. His calculations, compared to his father's, showed that he was 160 miles west of the ancient ruined city that the Matabele called Zimbabwe, the burial place of the old kings. Then, while he waited for darkness to resume the march, he took from his saddlebags the sheaf of notes which Zuga had given him as a parting gift when he first left Kimberley. He read the description of the route to Zimbabwe and of the city itself, for possibly the 100th time.
"How much longer must we march through these hills?" Isasi broke his concentration.
He was cooking maize cakes on a small smokeless fire of dry wood.
"My beasts suffer on these rocks and steep places," he grumbled. "We should have gone further south and passed below the hills on the open ground."
"Where Lobengula's bucks wait and pray every day for the chance to stick an assegai through a skinny little Zulu," Ralph smiled.
"There is the same danger here."
"No," Ralph shook his head. "No Matabele comes into these sacred hills without good reason. We will find no impi here, and once we come out on the far side, we will be beyond the furthest regimental kraals."
"And this place of stone to which we go? There will be no impi waiting for us there?"
"Lobengula forbids any man even to look into the valley in which the stones stand. It is a death-mark place, cursed by Lobengula and his priests."
Itzatzi shifted uncomfortably. "Who sets store by the curse of a fat Matabele dog?"
he demanded, and touched the charm on his belt, which warded off devils and hobgoblins and other dark secret things. Despite his assurances to Isasi, Ralph moved with utmost caution in threading the maze of the Matopus. During daylight he hid the bullocks in some thick patch of bush in a rock gorge, and he went ahead to reconnoitre every yard of the way and to mark it for Isasi to follow with a discreetly blazed tree trunk or a broken twig of green leaves at every turning or difficult place. These precautions saved him from disaster. On the third day, he had tied Tom in good cover and gone forward on foot to the ridge from where he could look into the next valley. Just below the brow, he was alerted by the raucous alarm call of a grey lory, the go-away bird of the African bush. The cry came from just beyond the ridge, and as he froze to listen, he heard a gentle susurration like the wind in tall grass. He ducked and jumped off the path, sprawling on his belly with his rifle tucked into the crook of his elbows, and rolled under the spreading branches of a low red berry bush, just as the first rank of Matabele warriors came sweeping over the rise ahead of him, with their cloaks and kilts and headdresses rustling, the sound which had warned him. From where he lay under the bush beside the path, Ralph could see only as high as their knees as they passed, but their gait was that determined business-like trot which the Matabele called Minsa Khlabati, to eat the earth greedily. He counted them.
200 warriors in all went past, and the soft rustle of their feet dwindled. But Ralph lay frozen beneath his bush, not daring even to creep deeper into the undergrowth. Minutes later, he heard the soft chant of bearers coming up from the next valley. And then they were trotting past his hiding place, singing the praise song to the king in their deep melodious voices. Ralph could tell by the spacing and weight of their gait that they were carrying a heavy litter. He had guessed that the leading band was merely a vanguard. This was the main party. While the person on the litter was without any doubt Lobengula himself, and following him were his attendants, his high indunas and other important personages. After them again, more bearers carrying sleeping mats and carosses of fur, beer pots and leather sacks of maize meal and other burdens. They filed past and disappeared. But still Ralph did not rise from hiding. Another long silence, and then, with only a soft warning rustle, came the rear guard. 200 more picked warriors trotting past. After 5 minutes, Ralph felt it was safe to crawl out onto the path and dust the damp leaf mould from his knees and elbows. From the top of the ridge he stared back in the direction which Lobengula's party had taken, puzzled as to where they were all headed and why. He knew from Cathy that Rudd and his party were still at Kubulawayo, and that Clinton, Codrington and Robin were with them, negotiating the concession that Mr. Rhodes so desperately needed. Why would Lobengula leave such important guests at his kraal and come up here into these sacred and deserted hills? There was no answer, and Ralph had to be content with having so narrowly escaped discovery and to be now alerted to the presence of large parties of warriors in the area. He moved forward with even more caution than before, so that it took 3 more nights of travel at the pace of the bullocks before they came out of another pass between bald granite cliffs and saw the open forests of tall and lovely trees rolling away below them, silver and charcoal in the moonlight. In the dawn, Ralph climbed the cliff to the peak of the last of the Matopus Hills, and on the eastern horizon, almost exactly where he had hoped to find it, he picked out the far blue silhouette of a solitary kopje standing above the forested plain. It was still 30 miles distant, but the shape of a crouching lion was unmistakable, and it fitted exactly the description in Zuga Ballantyne's notes. The hill which I have named Lion's Head stands high above the surrounding terrain and points the traveller unerringly towards Great Zimbabwe. A man might have walked in the shadow of the massive stone walls and never known they were there, so dense was the growth that covered them. It was a jungle of liana and flowering creepers, while from the very walls themselves grew the twisting serpentine roots of the strangler figs, wedging open the mortarless joints of the stonework and bringing it down in screes of fallen blocks. Above the level of the high walls soared the heads of other tall trees, grown to giants in the time since the last inhabitant had fled this place, or died within its labyrinth of passages and courtyards. When Zuga Ballantyne had discovered this massive keep before Ralph's birth, it had taken him almost 2 days to find the narrow gateway under this mass of tangled vegetation, but now his directions and descriptions led Ralph immediately to it. He stood before the ancient portals and looked up at the pattern of chevron stone blocks which decorated the top of the wall 30 feet above his head, and was seized with a primeval superstitious awe. Though he could see the marks of his father's axe and the old stumps cut away on each side of the opening, a veil of trailing plants had regrown to screen the gateway, proof that no human being had entered since Zuga's visit more than 25 years before. The steps that led up to the gateway had been dished by the passage of the feet of the ancient inhabitants over the centuries. Ralph drew a deep breath and silently reminded himself that he was a civilized Christian. But his superstitious fears lingered as he climbed the stairs, ducked under the trailing creepers, and stepped through the gateway. He found himself in a narrow, twisted stone gut between high walls open to the sky. He followed the passage, clambering over fallen stonework blocks and forcing his way through brush and undergrowth that choked it, until abruptly he came out into a wide courtyard dominated by an immense cylindrical tower of lichen-coated grey granite.